It's time for What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.
Morena, Steve.
Morena, how are you?
Hi, yeah, Steve. Good, thank you. How are you this morning?
Pretty good.
Oh, very good. I'm excited to get into this. We've got a couple of things to talk about. I reckon we should start with farrowing crates. It's been a big thing on people's mind over the past few weeks, and we've seen Agriculture Minister Andrew Hoggard pass a bill that will cancel the ban on farrowing crates, which was due to kick in December under the last government. And meanwhile, keeping crates in existence and giving pig farmers 10 years to adapt to slightly tougher restrictions. Is this a failure in terms of animal welfare, not banning farrowing crates now?
Yeah, it's a total failure, and it's an appalling failure of democracy, frankly. I mean, the minister's had 2 years knowing the deadline's looming, the 18th of December, based on a High Court decision in 2020 that said we had to get rid of farrowing crates. And, well, farrowing crates were contradictory to our own animal welfare laws, unlawful. So there's a five-year grace period given to the industry. And right at the 11th hour, Hoggard rushes through this bill, which we're having hearings on today and tomorrow only, and then he's trying to get it done before this deadline comes up, after which farrowing crates will be unlawful again. And the bill basically says 10 more years of the status quo. And let's remember, we've already had 5 years of mother pigs and piglets being allowed to be encaged in steel cages for days before giving birth and then weeks after they're given birth to nurse the young. And one thing that I had explained to me by the SPCA is that a mother pig can't even turn around in these cages, and in the 48 hours before they give birth, they have a profound need to build a nest, and they can't do it. And so it's deeply stressful for the mother pigs, and it's just fundamentally cruel.
This
should be got rid of.
They're highly controversial, the farrowing crates, because at the same time as it being a risk in terms of animal welfare for mother pigs, they do prevent piglet death from mother pigs crushing the piglets. Is that right?
So that's the argument of the industry. But one thing that happens is the stress that it causes the mother pig means that they have an increased number of stillbirths. So the piglets die in utero. After they're born, there's fewer that are crushed. And for context, the pigs are bred so huge now that it is a problem with them managing protection of the young. But there's a factor of any form of pig farming, the piglets will get squashed periodically.
Yeah.
On balance, you get the same number of, if you include stillbirths and crushing, you get the same number in free farrowing arrangements as you do in farrowing, just that the pigs and the piglets are much more content in terms of their welfare. And as within a few days, the mother pig is communicating to the piglets about when she's going to lie down again, and she's constantly managing the protection of them. So you talk to animal welfare experts rather than the pork industry, and they'll tell you it's far, far better animal welfare-wise and for the dignity and life of the animals that you put them into free farrowing pens where they're allowed to move around freely and build a nest and express their natural behaviours.
It's interesting because a lot of the outcry, as you say, has been about a sense of perhaps a breach of democracy and that not enough animal welfare groups were consulted around this, as opposed to NZ Pork being given a lot of sort of insight and a lot of the planned changes in 10 years' time reflecting their 2022 submission. But, I mean, is it normal for us to, when we have policy that is going to largely affect a particular industry, isn't it normal for us to consult the people that it's going to affect, or do you feel as though it's gone too far here?
I don't think there's any problem with consulting the people in the industry, but you should also consult the independent experts on animal welfare, particularly when you're the Associate Minister of Animal Welfare. He's not the Minister of Pork Farming. His first responsibility is to protection of the welfare of animals. And so he should be listening to the advice from the National Animal Welfare Board, which told him we need to move to free farrowing away from farrowing crates. And he should consult, if he's making a new plan, as he has done in the last year, with the animal welfare experts. He hasn't done that at all. He's cut and pasted the preferred outcome of the pork industry word to word. So this is a minister who is totally doing the bidding of the pork industry, not working for the welfare needs of animals, and that's meant to be his job.
It does feel as though perhaps we're getting slightly conflicted messages, though, from animal welfare groups, doesn't it? Because the SPCA has said that they're completely blindsided by this, but NAWAC were consulted. It just feels as though maybe they weren't listened to.
Yeah, NAWAC are in a difficult position because they're set up to serve the government of the day. And in fact, this legislation, one of the other scurrilous things it does is it will force NAWAC into a position of supporting what the minister decides. And that's, another failure of actual independent consultancy from experts on animal welfare. You can rely on those well-respected, long-standing advocates in the space, such as SPCA. They're the ones telling you an independent version of the truth in terms of animal welfare, because their interest is protection of animals. It's not how to potentially make things easier for the pork industry. But on that count, I think they're actually really letting down pig farmers, because half of New Zealand pig farmers already farm without farrowing crates. And this is a transition that's already been underway. And the ones who have done the right thing are now being disadvantaged by those who are not going to do the right thing over the next 10 years. And it gives no certainty to that industry, because this legislation cannot last. The change of government will see a change in the rules around this. So it doesn't give confidence to pig farmers even in terms of what they should be investing in. The safest thing is to move to free farrowing. We can all agree on that.
It's interesting that there's been pretty little innovation in the sense that they're just sticking right to the status quo.
It's a problem of a mindset you get actually across a lot of industries, but certainly right. The agriculture sector is that the status quo is people get trapped and blinkered in a thing that this is all we can keep doing. And so we can slightly tweak the status quo, but we can't move to a significantly different system. Yet around the world, people are moving away from farrowing crates to farrowing pens and free farrowing because you get such better outcomes. And it's not tenable for us to keep locking these highly intelligent animals who want to care for their young and express their natural behaviours into a cage where they can't even turn around. It's just revolting, and we cannot tolerate it. 75% of New Zealanders, when polled, to see farrowing crates gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all sort of hope that everyone cares deeply about animal welfare. But I guess realistically, in terms of the logistics of it all, if the government has been stalling too much or hasn't prepared enough for a complete ban to kick in from December, isn't it sort of necessary for farmers and for the industry to adapt to have a little bit more time? Or do you feel that it's just poor planning?
It's desperately poor planning. And look, SPCA would say that we can give them more time, but there has to be a hard deadline, and that needs to be more time to get rid of farrowing crates altogether. The current plan in 10 years will only require an increase in the size of the cages by 13.3%. So it's basically locking in the status quo with a slightly bigger cage.
No.
If the move was towards a total to free farrowing, then a bit more time would be something tenable that we could consider, and I think that's reasonable. But what the minister has come in and said is, oh no, you're going to have more time, 10 more years to keep doing what you're doing, you don't have to do anything, and then you can move to a slightly bigger cage, but we're still going to have farrowing crates.
So if this longer period to adapt does come into play and stays with whatever government comes in next year, would you want to see more put in place to help that transition come along quicker?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think it's reasonable to think that, there could be ways of looking at how we make the transition happen better. But right now, from a Green point of view, we're feeling pretty pissed off with the industry, and, they have had lots of time and they're really dragging their heels on this. And how much leeway do you give them? It's basic animal welfare. It's our own laws that this bill is actually overriding. It's allowing unlawful practice to continue being lawful. That's what this bill does. If the bill didn't come into force on the 18th of December, these pig farmers who are still using farrowing crates would be up for prosecution. And so, we have these pretty good animal welfare laws. This law is allowing farmers to break it.
I want to move now quickly to the Takutai Moana Amendment Bill, which has passed its third and final reading in Parliament this week. What does this mean for the bill moving forward?
I mean, the bill is a, I've said it before, it's an awful piece of law, and it's probably a centrepiece of the nastiness that this government has expressed towards iwi Māori. And undermine the treaty. And for context, you know, the basic principle of it is that and even in countries where they don't have treaties as we do, we have this profound and visionary basis upon which to build our nation, as Moana Jackson called it, Te Tiru Te Wai, 1840. And we just had Hei Whakaputanga celebrated yesterday, 1835. But in countries where they don't have treaties, like Australia, the Mabo case is based, you may or may not know the Mabo case, but it's a famous case based on native land title, or what they call Aboriginal title, which is a recognition that even in British common law, which is the imposed legal system, obviously, in our parts of the world, there's a recognition that if, you know, the Jones family have been collecting firewood from the Nottingham Forest for 200 years, then the Jones family have customary use of the Nottingham Forest for firewood collection. So it's an ancient concept of recognising uses that people make of the commons. And before the enclosure of the commons in Britain, which was a terrible thing, that's a long recognised concept in British law. So when they brought the Mabo case in Australia, it was using the principle of customary use and saying this Aboriginal iwi have been living here for tens of thousands of years, or, you know, at least centuries. They have some form of native title over this land, and you can't have a sheep farmer coming in and kicking them off it. That's the basis of native title. So customary use in the Takutai Moana, the marine coastal environment, predates any necessity for Te Tiru Te Waitangi. It actually is a long-standing principle that iwi Māori have been here for centuries and centuries, obviously interacting and using and having relationship and customary use of the foreshore and the seabed for fishing, for recreation, for management, kaitiakitanga and imposing of rahui and what have you, all of those interactions. And then 2004, they come along and basically extinguish that, the foreshore and seabed confiscation, says, oh no, we're not going to recognise that customary title. There's not going to be a pathway through the courts to get that recognised, which is outrageous, and this massive backlash that occurred. There was a resolution in 2011 under a national government in coalition with Te Pāti Māori, was that we will have a pathway for recognition of customary use, but a relatively high bar. That's been in place since then, and a number of iwi have gone to court and succeeded, had their customary title recognised. This government comes on and goes, hang on a minute, we can't have this. This is too much. There's, you know, there's too much risk of iwi having a right to refuse consent in certain marine environments, which is a barrier to capitalist exploitation of those environments. So we're going to retrospectively undo those legal cases, raise the bar even higher, making it nearly impossible for you to prove that they have customary use, even though it's blatantly obvious to all of us that we might have been here for centuries and obviously have interacted with the marine coastal environment. And it's a terrible act of confiscation is what they're basically doing. It's a return to that Aupatu of 2004. And just for clarity, because this is one of the misnomers, customary use can be shared by multiple people. So customary use does not, in the 2011 Act, the original MACA Act, Marine Coastal Area Act, doesn't stop public use. It doesn't impact public use. The public still have access to the beaches and the coastline and so forth. That's protected under the Marine and Coastal Area Act.
Paul Goldsmith has sort of framed the bill as restoring the original legislative intent, or sort of clarifying an older law. What's your response to this?
It's garbage. Goldsmith is telling porkies. He's just not telling the truth. And you can ask the former, you know, Minister of Justice and Attorney General, Chris Finlayson, who created the Marine and Coastal Area Act in 2011, and Finlayson has been extremely forthright in his disdain for this amendment by Goldsmith, and said that it does not restore the original intent. And one of the fundamental things it does is it shifts the burden of proof from the Crown having to prove extinguishment to Ngā-Iwi Māori having to prove that they've had unextinguished use since 1840, which is a very difficult thing to prove because in that period colonisation happened, and which is recognised as one of the biggest causes of a disconnection of iwi Māori from their customary marine coastal environment. And so the bar has been raised much higher, and the burden of proof, rather than being put on the Crown to prove extinguishment of customary use, is now back on, or being put on iwi Māori to prove that the customary use hasn't been extinguished. And that's a very difficult test to meet at the burden of Māori, who are, in fact, the ones who have suffered the impact of colonisation. So it's completely unjust.
Mm. Unfortunately, that's just about all we've got time for, but thank you very much, Steve, for joining us for a kōrero this morning. Always good to hear your whakaaro. And we're excited to see you with the Exploding Rainbow Orchestra next week.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you got a good song up your sleeve for us?
I do. We're not allowed to tell you about our songs, though. So okay. On the day. I'm super excited and quite nervous about it because I haven't been playing much, so I'm doing lots of rehearsaling, but really excited. I've seen the Exploding Rainbow Orchestra a couple of times, and they're absolutely superb.
Yeah, they're pretty stellar, eh?
I'm sure you'll be fine. You'll be fun.
You're in good company with the lineup, eh?
My goodness. At least everyone else will be good. I'm honoured to be part of it.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Steve, and we'll see you next week on stage.
Nice. See you then.
Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was What's Up with Steve Abel from the Green Party.